And good morning, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Other Side of Midnight. It is Saturday morning, end of another week. That kind of magic time at this hour between dusk and dawn where the things that we kind of pass by in daytime and go, oh, come on, that can't be true. This time of night, you know, you take a second look and you look at the evidence, and we're going to be going some very extraordinary places this morning. I'm going to talk to an old friend of mine who has been doing tabletop experiments in torsion. And the only thing missing from tabletop experiments in torsion is a suitable torsion field generator. So you can do your tabletop experiments in your kitchen, not blowing up your kitchen. We don't want to do that. So we'll talk to our guest later in the morning about how we can do that and where you get torsion sources and all kinds of cool stuff like that. Before we get there, however, I want to pick up on a couple of points. In a few hours, it's something like 8:51 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, the Juno spacecraft, remember the spacecraft that a little over a month ago was put into orbit in the wee hours around Jupiter? It is going to whiz past the planet in this very long looping polar orbit. Remember, it's now in a polar orbit of Jupiter, in an extremely elongated egg-shaped orbit that takes it like 6 weeks to go around once, I think. Well, this morning, in a few hours, that Juno spacecraft, after its insertion into orbit on July 4th, is coming back around now, is making its second pass closest to the planet. In fact, it will be only, at closest approach, 2,600 miles above the cloud tops. I mean, imagine, you're on a planet, well, you're not on it, you're kind of above it, which is 10 times the size of the Earth, 80-some thousand miles across. And you're streaking like a little dragonfly, 2,500 miles, 2,600 miles above the cloud tops near the North Pole of a planet that's bigger than all the other planets of the whole solar system all put together. Isaac Asimov said many, many years ago that the solar system consists of the Sun and Jupiter and some debris. Well, Jupiter is big, and Jupiter is amazing, and we're going to get our first close-up images from the camera on board Juno. Not live this morning. They could have done that, but they aren't doing that. They're going to take a look at them, and then they're going to give them to us, we think, later next week. They should be spectacular, because coming in, you know, the planet getting bigger and bigger and those incredible storms and all that. I mean, 2,600 miles. It's going to look like a multicolored carpet. The horizon is going to be barely bending, barely curving. It'd be like flying on the Earth. You know, when you're up at around 40,000 feet, you can see the curvature of the Earth if you look carefully. Well, we're not going to see curvature. We're going to see basically a flat horizon from a spacecraft 2,500 miles above. That's as far away as I am from New York right now tonight. So that's going to be pretty amazing, and they're going to have all the instruments on, and we're going to get some extraordinary data on the physics, since physics is the subject of the evening. We're going to get extraordinary data on the internal physics of Jupiter, and they're going to confirm what I have been saying for many, many years. They may not do it right away, but Jupiter and the rest of the solar system are operating according to the hyperdimensional physics model that we're going to talk about this morning with my friend, Tim. Because he's found a way to do tabletop experiments so you too, in your own kitchen or your bathroom, can actually demonstrate that torsion is real and it has remarkable effects, including one of the things that I didn't quite think of when I started looking into these things some years ago, the effects on women, on beauty products. Now, that's pretty intriguing. So we're going to get to all that. And I want to pick up another couple things when we come back at the other side of the break. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard Z. Hoagland. It is Saturday morning. We're in 155 countries, people, all over the world. So stay tuned. We shall return.
Instead, you
And we are back on the other side of midnight on this Saturday morning. Before we get going, I want to remind you, we do have Facebook pages and we do have Twitter. And if you want to join the conversation, go to othersideofmidnight.com on Facebook. And I guess you don't need the .com. It's Other Side of Midnight on Facebook. Their system is so intriguingly arcane. And we'll give out phone numbers for when you want to join the conversation that way. But at the moment, if you go to theothersideofmidnight.com and you go to the upper left-hand corner, we have Facebook connections, we have Twitter connections, we have Google connections, we have YouTube, we have it all. And incidentally, if you want to recommend people for Club 19.5, you actually make a buck on it, I think. Go and read on the left-hand side on the announcements page and you will see how that all works, because, again, without the archive, these programs over time may not make as much sense as they will if you, in fact, dip into the archive and become a member. I mean, come on, $5 a month? That's coffee at Starbucks. That's not even coffee at Starbucks anymore. Anyway, my guest this morning, we're going to have a very interesting time, because this is someone I wanted to have on the show for some time. Tim Winey was born in Omaha, Nebraska in 1966 and moved to California when he was 1 year old. Timothy fell in love with classical music at that early age and went on to study music and educational studies at both California State University in Fresno and California State University in Sacramento. Many of the principles of vibration, harmony, attunement, and harmonic geometries that he gleaned from his studies of stringed instruments have been incorporated into his inventions and his innovations and his experiments with torsion fields and structured water. For the last 10 years, Timothy has been conducting independent research on non-classical field effects on water and other liquids. After a series of highly anomalous results, which of course we're going to go through this morning, both commercial and academic, interest in his work has intensified, and recently attention has been focused on his discoveries in the area of fuels, foods, and health applications. More specifically, the use of structured water for the improved uptake of phytocompounds. And I have a feeling that has something to do with what women put on their faces. So without further ado, welcome to the other side of midnight, Tim.
Thank you, Richard. It's a real pleasure.
Do you want Tim or Timothy?
Either way.
Either way. Okay. Well, I'll probably slop back and forth. Gosh, you know, where do we begin? I know how I got into all this. As a musician, and we kind of share that as well, what got you looking at resonance and field effects? And, I mean, this is so far afield as a kind of an amateur physicist from being a professional musician. So track us through your music interest and how that kind of suddenly broadened into what we're going to talk about this morning.
Right. Well, it is a very twisted tale, and it's only until quite recently, actually, that I began reflecting on, you know, the origins, if you will, of these interests. And sometimes we're blind to our own,
curiosities?
Points of inspiration or curiosity, right. So I studied violin from a young age, and I think just naturally gravitated toward tonal music, harmonious vibration. And only much later did I realize, after having actually studied violin making from a very brilliant pair of gentlemen, one of whom was a physicist and retired airline pilot.
Oh, you went looking after the secret of the Stradivarius.
Correct. And he had his own drawings, or method of drawing, rather, of an Amati violin that was based almost exclusively on phi triangles. So the violin itself is just, it's almost like a hologram of phi. I mean, all the ratios.
Oh, really?
Yes, it's absolutely a phi machine. In fact, the violin is 10 times louder than common noise. That's why you're able to project it in large halls.
Because of the resonance of the music box and all that.
And the ratios, because as you know, they're non-destructive. And you know, Patrick Flanagan talks about this notion that, I asked him on the telephone once, I said, at the end of the day, doesn't a theory of everything will a theory of everything not have to revolve around phi? And he said, absolutely, because when you have a non-destructive wave form, you can modulate from sound all the way up to light and beyond. There's no other ratio that allows us to travel through all these different bands. And so any universal law that governs motion, time, energy, you name it, would have to obey these almost Pythagorean, you know, string laws and which revolve around this phi. In fact, the violin itself is tuned to phi. In other words, the musical fifth in music is 3/5. It's the phi ratio. So how strange is that?
Well, given what we're going to talk about, I don't think it's strange at all. I think it's actually connected. In other words, whoever designed the violin, and we talk about inventions, we talk about evolutionary growth, there are times, I think, in history, Tim, when I look back and I see that information has somehow been dumped onto us from some source.
Right.
It's like it arrives, as John Anthony West said, fully blown, fully formed. Like you suddenly
look
out. Well,
the plot thickens, yes. I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but I must interject here. There are some fairly serious people who believe that, well, first of all, the violin literally is like an evolutionary skip. In other words, the closest thing we have to the violin is these vials, these old lutes, not lutes, but vials. They were weird instruments, middle-aged instruments that bore no resemblance to the modern tuning of the violin. They had more strings. They were just completely different. And suddenly there emerges this, you know, spaceship from a Cessna. There's nothing in between. And it's tuned to this phi ratio. Now, who was obsessed with sacred geometry? Who was obsessed with the phi ratio, the golden ratio? And who lived in northern Italy at that time? And who was experimenting with instrumental design?
Oh, don't tell me you're going to mention the guy. Leonard. Leonardo.
So there are very serious people who think that the violin in its modern form was invented by him. Furthermore, the plot thickens again. The violin was originally, and by originally I mean Amati, Steiner, Stradivari, Guarneri, all the old original violins, were all tuned to 432. It's only until modern times that we began tuning them up to 440 and even higher. And some folks think that was a Nazi conspiracy to agitate people and make music more annoying or
really
agitating. Correct. Yes. Yeah, so there's a whole theory surrounding this 432.
My gosh, that sounds like a whole show in itself, in and of itself.
It is. In fact, 432 is related to the speed of light and the circumference of the earth, and around we go. So it really can't. These things, while Leonardo may not have invented the violin, it really is a mind-boggling series of coincidences.
Well, wait, you really piqued my curiosity here because it's connected to what we want to talk about later, but you're telling me that in the fossil record of musical instruments going back through history, there's no real evolutionary set of steps from whatever was being played a couple right. hundred years ago to the modern violin. It just kind of suddenly appears.
Giant missing link.
It just appears?
Yeah.
And it's geometric. It's based on the phi, and it's got these triangles and the shape
correct.
And the. That's astonishing, Tim.
And if you look at Leonardo's elaborate drawings of musical instruments, it's not a hard connection to make.
Wow.
Imagination.
Did you watch Da Vinci's Demons at all? Do you get it over there?
No.
Oh. There's a whole show on Stars about Da Vinci. Very, very elaborate, very novelized, very fictionalized, but it's got a thread of something running through it. And when I made that reference before about some information that just kind of appears to be full-blown, just drops out of the sky,
right.
I had no idea the violin, the most incredible instrument for making music I think has ever been invented, is in that category.
Which is the closest, you know, replicant of the human voice, you know. I mean, it's...
No, I didn't know that.
yeah, I mean, the violin is considered and has been, well, not just considered, but in terms of similarity, there's no other instrument that can mimic the human voice more closely.
So when you get into your music career, you really got into it, and you know, because you have this science bent. I mean, you remind me in some ways of a guy in France, Maurice Allais, who won the 1988 Nobel Prize for Economics. But he only did that because his mommy said he had to go into something that would make him money. He really was a closet physicist, and he invented all these amazing, astonishing physical measurements and systems. And you know, the French Academy has awarded him. He has now gone, but they awarded him several prizes. So he really should have been a physicist. Well, Tim, are you telling me that really a musician was not what you ultimately found out you wanted to be? You wanted to be someone who understood how the music gets made?
Well, you know, I'm just too dumb for that. I can't even add fractions half the time. I deal at the concept level, and a lot of the deeper math is lost on me. And I think it's just a side effect of having a different brain. I really do. I read a fascinating book many years ago as a teenager, because even then I kind of had a suspicion my brain worked a little differently. And I actually do have a different brain. I have a sleep disorder, which I won't bore you with. But I read a book called The Psychology of Invention. And this guy went around and he interviewed famous inventors. And I mean famous, like, you know, Edison. And he devised a kind of a scientific profile of what makes up an inventor. And they are different. They're not scientists. They're not content to study the beat patterns of a butterfly for 35 years. You know, they're impatient people. They want to learn just enough about something to get going with it. So they're not terribly obsessed with, you know, just studying it.
You mean they want a practical result?
They do. They're impatient. They want a result. Well, I'm also like that, but with the exception that I also have a sort of an undercurrent running where I do want to understand how these things work, but I have to, when I bump into some higher math and things that are out of my depth, I have to be humble enough to ask for help from folks cleverer and more classically trained than I. But I also have very thick skin, and it's very hard to offend me. So I bump into people in academia that sometimes don't really quite know what to make of me. And I've had some funny interactions, which I think your audience would find quite hilarious, actually.
Well, anytime you have to talk to academia about real knowledge, real discovery, real science, it can get kind of strange.
Well, I'll give you one really funny anecdote, and I will conceal the names of the not-so-innocent here.
Okay.
I approached a top university in the United Kingdom, and when I say top, I mean tippity-top, and I approached their top fuel chemist, and I said, look, I know this sounds absolutely crazy, and I'm sure you get, you know, all kinds of people bugging you, but I have devised a method for treating fuel using a resonance process, and this fuel treatment seems to render a diesel fuel almost odorless, which is in and of itself very strange. But there's a theory of smell posited by a guy named Luca Turin. So if you remind me later, I'll circle back to Luca Turin, which explains.
Is that based on geometry of molecules?
It's based on their vibration.
Ah, okay.
So the size and shape of molecules ultimately don't determine their smell. It's actually their vibration. So,
interesting. How the vibration interacts with our vibration.
Yes, and it's a quantum effect, and there's tunneling involved, and Luca Turin is, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, now we're getting way ahead of our story, so let's get back to the guy. What was
so
his
back
response?
To fuel. So I asked this scientist, this chemist, this fuel chemist, if he would be...
At a major British university.
Yes, if he would be so interested as to explain to me how it's possible that while going uphill under a steady load, in other words, the vehicle's at the same RPM, same speed, you know, on a steady uphill grade, how I can get 60 miles per gallon doing that and 30 going downhill.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is, of course, sounds like ridiculous breach of the second law. So he writes me back and says, Dear Mr. Winey, I regret to inform you that I will be unable to assist you in this matter, as what I believe you have witnessed is a miracle.
Ha! Oh my God. It's too bad you can't tell us his name or the university, because that in the 21st century has got, you got to frame that letter. You got to print it out and frame it.
Actually, I should add on top of this an even more ridiculous story, which it's just coming back to me now. I think I blocked these things out due to the trauma they caused me. I contacted the California Air Quality Board many years ago. Now, in fairness to them, this is before I had these tests under my belt. But, you know, it's like anything else. People say, well, if this is really great, wouldn't universities want to study it? Well, Exhibit A, you have a miracle. Right? So I contact the California Air Quality Board, which is basically the Environmental Protection Agency, and they do fuel testing. It's in Southern California, emissions testing. I said, look, I know you get crackpots, you know, contacting you, and you're busy, so I'll keep it brief. I'm prepared to pay for the transportation of fuel from you to me, hermetically sealed, which I will treat and then send back to you for analysis, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And their response was, we can't do that because we think it might break our mass spectrometer.
What?
You heard me.
What?
You heard me. So I said, how could it break your
mass spectrometer? These are nitwit responses.
I said, it's unopened. So I got the guy on the phone. I couldn't believe it. I thought he was pranking me. So I called this guy, and he says, we can't test this. I said, I'll pay for everything. He says, nope, because it might break our machine. I said, do you realize what you're saying? You're actually saying that there's such a thing as fuel homeopathy. You're saying that if I hire some Buddhist monks to pray over this fuel and alter it, it's going to damage your equipment, right? So awkward silence. So then the guy says, well, we don't have any insurance. I said, well, what do you mean you don't have insurance? He said, we don't have any insurance on this equipment, and it's expensive. I said, your insurance is the taxpayer. If my, you know, magic fuel treatment breaks your machine, I'm sure, you know, the taxpayer would be happy to fix it for you. Nope, can't do it. But then he said, here's the laugher. He says, but if you can find another university to do some testing where you are, then we might consider it. Well, at which point I wouldn't need you, right? Like go to the bank when you don't.
Yeah.
Rich people get loans from the bank all the time, right? What do I need you for? So there you go. I even wrote Dianne Feinstein's office and explained. She never responded.
Hmm. So, okay, let's back up. We got about 6 minutes till the bottom of the hour, and we have a break then. How did you get from music? Because you wound up playing in extraordinary places like the Azores. How did you get from music into looking at vibration, and then from there to something called torsion?
Well, I was reading quite heavily across, you know, a wide range of subjects, connecting dots with vibration and old stuff. I was reading old Wilhelm Reich stuff, and even going back to people like Gustav Le Bon, who before he got into sociology had a quite complete theory of everything physics, kind of an ether physics. And I connected with a brilliant doctor who's very well known in bioenergetics, who wrote a brilliant monograph on the electrical properties of cancer cells.
Mm.
And he connected the dots between Gilbert Ling and Max Gearson and Anton Breyer with the famed Breyer machine and all these very esoteric and highly technical technologies dealing with bioenergetics. So I thought, well, this guy can't be a faker because he's connected all these
dots. So we're talking about energy medicine as opposed to take a pill.
Correct. And so I corresponded voluminously with him, began experimenting with my own concoctions dealing with the vibration and fairly high-tech frequency equipment. And then also, in parallel with that, began working in the area of paramagnetism, flowing from the work of Phil Callahan, because the Azores is highly paramagnetic, and of course, a magnetite are just little pyramids, so this notion of pyramid power is tied in with paramagnetism. And so began corresponding with John Malewski, who's an actual rocket scientist turned subtle energy researcher. And Malewski does these experiments with, you know, volcanic rock, and he structures water, and you drink the water, and it reverses gray hair and makes your plants grow faster. These are all real effects. They're actually easily demonstrated. So picking up from Malewski, who himself has a brilliant sort of theory of everything's what he calls superlight, which is explains action at a distance and all these you know, dark energies and so on, I began forming a kind of a working theory about what's really going on. And I only recently was able to use my equipment to transfer these charge effects to intermediate substances. So now I have portable, quote, chargers, unquote. So we can take a little, I call it a battery, it's not a battery, but I could take a little charger and place it near a can of fuel or near a bucket of water and alter the physiochemistry.
Okay, so I'll tell you, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning is Timothy Winey. We're discussing the underpinnings of torsion. And as you're going to hear as we go through the morning, some remarkable tabletop experiments that you too, if you figure out how to generate torsion, and we're going to get to that in a little while, you can do in your own kitchen and not destroy it. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And we're back on the other side of midnight with my guest this morning, Tim Winey. So let's need to go a little slow here because a lot of people are going to get lost between a guy who's a musician, who's a professional musician, who's actually hired to play in various parts of the world, winding up ultimately in England to play and to teach music, and he suddenly gets into playing with bottles and liquids and charges and vibration. I mean, walk us across that gap. How did you get from being a musician to being a scientist?
Right. Well, I had corresponded with John Malewski on and off.
And tell us who John is.
John is a very clever man who worked for 40 years at Los Alamos. He's an actual rocket scientist. And in fact, he has some solid fuel patents that were used in space and military. So very clever guy who sort of picking up on theories laid out by Phil Callahan, who studied volcanic rocks and round towers in Ireland.
By the way, speaking of Callahan, I have been looking through my files for literally decades, a couple of decades, for a paper by Callahan measuring the responses of a ficus in his office with an electrocardiogram, some kind of, you know, like a chart recorder, during a Venus transit. And I know he wrote that up, and I can't find it anywhere. Do you know where I can find it? Because that's an amazing paper by Callahan, which,
yes,
of course, is so torsion-oriented and was behind, right, eventually us measuring the effects of the eclipse with the Accutron. So if you can find me that Callahan paper...
The walking encyclopedia on Callahan is a retired immunologist friend of mine here in England named Roger Taylor. And Roger Taylor is sort of like the Alexandria Library of all the subtle energy. In fact, Roger was at the conference this last summer in Bulgaria, and we had some great chats there. He's a really interesting guy. He does a lot of tests with... this so-called GDV, gas discharge visualization, these sort of modernized, updated version of Kirlian photography and other things.
Okay, so, I didn't mean to get us off track, but that Callahan paper is so important because it related to me the biology of the ficus wired up during a transit, showing there was some connection between this little plant in his office and an alignment of celestial bodies 25 million miles away. I mean, that really rang my chimes.
I mean, every other day I come across something explaining, you know, the effects of the moon and the planets, and you know, now they're not, now, you know, the science is too embarrassed to admit there's something to astrology, so now they call it astrobiology. In fact, there's a brilliant Russian physicist who presented at Varna. His name is Voyakov, and he's apps one of the, I think he's one of the 10 smartest people alive. And this was buried in the literature, but Voyakov, he had colleagues at Moscow State University that were able to definitively show that the radioactive decay rates of various substances varied based on the position of planets.
Oh, isn't that special?
So here you go. You know, I mean, just you don't hear about that anywhere. And how is that possible? I mean, we have nuclear clocks that are supposed to run on the predictability. Mm-hmm. Right, a radioactive decay.
Well, have you noticed that every once in a while the National Time Service over here adds a second, what they call a leap second?
Yeah.
You know, the Earth is going along, it's right. Rotating, and he's got these atomic clocks, and they're so super, super, super accurate, you know, to one ultimate 10 trillionth, trillionth of a second, and they have to adjust the rotation of the Earth to match the frequency of the atomic clocks, and they keep claiming nothing's wrong. Nothing to see here. Move along.
I didn't even want to go here, but I think it would be instructive if I start with a real small kind of a poor man's theory of space, so that when I go into these experiments, folks will have that to hang on to. So if you'll indulge me with 30 seconds.
Oh, by
seconds
all means.
Here. So I believe, and I come to this belief begrudgingly.
After how many years of experiments now have you done?
Oh, 10, 12 years, okay. You know, constantly. I believe that what Kozarev and others discovered was really a kind of a space geometry effect. And I think Flanagan would support me in this. In other words, Flanagan talks about, you know, pyramids being torsion field generators. And we all know that magnets have a subtle torsion field component. So
does Pat say they're generators or they're amplifiers?
Well, yeah, potato, potato. I think
No. There's a very important difference because a generator can create out of nothing.
Well, and that begs the question: what is space, time, energy, and the laws that govern everything? I think that all physical effects and all of what we perceive of as matter are really just special agglomerations of energy. So you have these little wavelets of energy, you know, coursing in and out of space, and depending on how they interact, they form the geometry of space. And if you're clever, you can cause slight asymmetries in space energy that steer it. In other words, the things that we think of as being physical things, atoms and even subatomic particles, are really just nodal points in a sea of jitter. Okay? And if you can steer this sea of jitter, you can cause things to magically self-organize. You can cause reverse entropy. You can inhibit putrefaction. I'll give you a funny but true anecdote. Flanagan talks in his Pyramid Power, which I think is out of print now, about this notion that, you know, pyramids can sharpen blades. Well, I taught primary school here in England. I had little 6-7-year-old kids, and they would, you know, stall for time by going to sharpen their pencils in slow motion with the old hand-crank pencil sharpener. And I said, guess what? We're not sharpening pencils anymore. I just took the pencil sharpener off the wall, and I said, if you need your pencil sharpened, you come to me. Well, of course, they were afraid to bring me a sharp pencil, so they would only come up if it was dull. And I would sharpen it very quickly with a very cheap little plastic pencil sharpener, the kind that kids would buy with a pencil, like in a store you go
in. Yeah, the kind you used to have in your book bag. It was a little plastic.
Yeah, like back to school, a little plastic sharpener. And those are only good for a half a dozen sharpenings. And then, of course, they're dull. Mm-hmm. Right? They don't last. And I used the same cheap little plastic pencil sharpener for 20 kids for a year.
What?
all I did was sharpen, you know, Johnny's pencil and then throw the sharpener in a little paper pyramid. The next kid came up, it was sharp. Yeah, so, I mean, that's free energy. That's over unity, that you have a magical blade sharpener in the form of a paper pyramid. Right? So don't tell me that there's no free lunch. The free lunch is in the form of a paper pyramid. That's pretty free as far as I'm concerned.
That's pretty cool. That's amazingly cool, Tim.
And I think that space actually has viscosity. I think that the more organized space is,
that's what Marie Soleil. There was a whole tradition, Tim, and you're part of this amazing tradition. There used to be a tradition before we had academic science and institutions and big science and multiple war boards and all that. The individual intellectual with curiosity, with a range of things at home. I mean, that's how science started. Everybody did tabletop experiments, and the best ones kept records. They kept track of organized processes for figuring out what was going on. So obviously that's a huge part of your DNA. So you're looking at this world of vibration, this musical world you're immersed in, and you're thinking what? That vibration is the key to everything?
Everything. In fact, Luca Turin says you can't smell. I mean, Luca Turin trained fruit flies to distinguish between deuterium and light water.
What?
Water's water. Water's water. And it's the same size and shape. So how the hell can you train a fruit fly to smell deuterium? The only answer is it vibrates at a slightly slower frequency.
It's got to be vibration.
Slightly heavier, correct. So using that theory of piggybacking on that theory of smell, I began to think, well, I must be altering the vibration of fuels if you can render diesel odorless in just a few minutes after exposing it to these fields. And water, of course, I mean, we take water and we put little polyacrylate beads in it, like the decorative water beads people used to put in vases. You don't see them much now, but, you know, these highly hydrophilic beads that soak up water. And we regularly get, and have never had an exception to this, 50% more uptake. Well, how is that possible? How is it possible that more water could go into these beads and they could get so much bigger? And so that led, of course, to this work with face creams and other things.
We're jumbling a whole bunch of stuff together. Let's back up way back. You're interested in vibration. How did you get to the idea of experimenting with water and liquids and stuff in your kitchen?
Right. Well, again, because John Maluski was able to show biologically that plants grew faster and hair changed color and all kinds of weird effects, I thought, you know what, I'm going to replicate these experiments using sort of an updated torsion technology that I cobbled together. And so it was actually serendipitous. I was doing these water experiments, and unbeknownst to me, these fields extend for some distance. Unbeknownst to me, I had a lawnmower sitting in a nearby tool shed that was affected by these fields, and I didn't know it at the time. So several months later, I go to cut the grass, and the lawnmower sounds like a Ferrari. It's running way too fast.
Really?
And it doesn't smell at all. So I went and got a home carbon monoxide detector, which beeps at 4 parts per million or something. I mean, they're very sensitive. And, of course, a lawnmower puts out, 60,000 parts per million of carbon monoxide. They're filthy. You know, these little engines are
a little two-cycle, very inefficient?
No, well, it's four-stroke, but it's there's no catalytic converter, there's no smog. So a lawnmower is so much filthier than a new car. You know, new cars are very clean. So, of course, I put the detector up to this lawnmower exhaust, and it wouldn't beep.
Oh.
Well, so you mean I can crack a window and run my lawnmower in my living room and not even get a headache? Are you kidding? Right? So I went and got all the neighbors' lawnmowers, and they beeped instantly. Okay. So that's when I wrote the guy at the university who said I witnessed a miracle, which we now know I did.
What year roughly was this?
Oh, this is like 4 years ago.
Okay.
So in a weird roundabout series of serendipity, I found out about a government scheme to research energy-efficient technology. And I went to a meeting in Cambridge here in England near where I live. And I told this guy, look, I can make a lawnmower burn cleaner than a new car. And it wouldn't take much to prove it. And he said, okay, we'll pay for that. So we had a study done at a good university where they filmed treated diesel being burned in an optical engine, right? So they inject the fuel and they videotaped this at 10,000 frames per second. And that's in the video in Varna. I demonstrate these videos. And the fuel wouldn't even burn. It was so delayed in combustion, it was just black smoke. Then when they adjusted the timing and injected the fuel with the bigger gap between the cylinder, you know, and the top of the cylinder stroke, then it just, the whole thing just instantly turned pink, isotropically just combusted, like no combustion anybody's ever seen. So naturally, that led to some interest. And we did follow-up testing in another university where they actually sent it off for independent chemical analysis, and they were able to show that the diesel fuel, the freezing point was changed by 3 degrees centigrade, which is a tremendous difference, and that the combustion was severely delayed, just as shown in the video. So that
okay, now we're missing a whole bunch of stuff here, because obviously you're talking about a fuel that you subjected to a proprietary treatment. And then you subjected it to these tests, and the tests confirm what you said was going to happen. But how do we get from music to working with fuels to make them? In other words, we're missing that connection.
Yeah. Well, the connection is all is vibration. And so I began playing with proprietary resonance technology that I believe, because of the health effects of it, fundamentally acted on the structure of water in the body. So I believe that, you know, you get a lot, there's a lot of sort of half-truths and a lot of misinformation on the internet. And if you read about Royal Raymond Rife, who was the famed inventor of this anti-cancer treatment using basically electric current at varying frequencies, you realize that he wasn't really killing bugs. He wasn't zapping them. It wasn't like a bug zapper. That's actually way overly simplistic. What people like Stephanie Seneff, who I'll go into a little bit of detail about, are now positing is the theory that the structure of water ultimately determines whether or not you're ill. So if you go in for an MRI, when they show you what you think is a tumor after they scan you, you're not looking at a tumor. You're looking at unstructured water around the tumor. That's what the MRI measures, okay? Mm-hmm. So she posits this very radical...
Now, who is she?
This is Stephanie Seneff, who is quite the pariah, because she claims, and I have no reason to disbelieve her, that the explosion of autism is not just down to vaccines, because they've been around for a long time, or even the increased rate of vaccination. She claims that it's the... synergy between metal-laden vaccines, primarily aluminum, and glyphosate. So it's Roundup plus aluminum that's causing blood to get sticky and causing microspores.
No, wait, this Stephanie is a doctor, a biologist in Britain.
She
now?
Is an MIT professor who started out life as a biologist and then got into artificial intelligence. But she, along with others, claim very persuasively that it is the structure of water in the body that indicates disease. Now, this begs the question, wait a minute, maybe unstructured
water...
So
we're actually talking about chicken and egg here. Which came first? Does the disease create the weird water,
correct,
or does weird
so
water
saying,
create disease?
Look, I posited this in very close quarters to people who I thought might not laugh at me. I posited the same theory, albeit crude, before I even knew about her paper. I said, what if when you look at an MRI and you look at unstructured water, which indicates cancer... What if you're looking at the cause rather than the effect of a disease. In other words, what if cancer doesn't cause water to become destructured? What if destructured water leads to cancer? Oh, and so which then
so and then what and then in the tumors you'd have an excess of unstructured water, which shows up in the MRI scans.
Correct. So if you don't have any unstructured water in your body, how can you get cancer? You follow me?
Yes.
So what if we just replace all the water in your body with structured water? Then could cancer not even manifest? Is because doesn't one define the other?
Interesting.
Follow me? So that's where things get really strange.
But see, that gets us to the geometry of water and the geometry of the field and the interaction between life and biology and the torsion field
Correct.
Itself and all of these interconnections. Let's get back to music and how you got interested in energy medicine. That's the thing I'm kind of missing.
That goes back to this doctor who was a Rife expert and who wrote this monograph, The Electrical Theory of Cancer Cells. Okay. And so I must back up and say that Stephanie Seneff's paper, which I'll send you, references all of her research only in relation to water that's been magnetized. So these are very weak effects. Okay, if you take a magnet, a strong permanent magnet, and you put it next to water, you will not get the effects that I'm measuring, right? You won't get these polymer beads swelling up 50% bigger. You won't get you won't stop the putrefaction of plants. They won't grow 2 to 3 times faster. So the effects that I'm generating are many, many times more robust than just simple magnetization. And yet...
So hang on. Your proprietary technology for structuring water is vastly more efficient than the current mechanisms that seem to be out there.
Well, then what she describes in her paper, which is just... straightforward magnetization. But as we know, magnets have many health benefits. I mean, I had arthritis in a toe and I put a strong magnet on there and the pain went away immediately. Mm. So, while magnets do have great power to structure water and have health effects, but, they don't double fuel economy. They don't cause, polymer beads to swell up like this. So it's a different.
So let's go back to how you got into experimenting with water, because that's a key thing to the opening of the rest of the conversation.
Right. So backing up, I realized that if Maluski could speed up plant growth with just simply by surrounding it with volcanic sand, then I could probably boost that using what I knew about torsion and frequency. So I decided to replicate a lot of his experiments with this torsion generators and got really crazy effects. In fact, I couldn't even wreck the effect by microwaving. So we would zap water with our system, then we would microwave it, and plants still grew like crazy. Whereas if we just microwave water, they wouldn't even germinate. I mean, elementary school kids can do these experiments. You microwave water, you let it cool, you water your house plants with it, they'll die. I mean, microwaving is actually very destructive. So so I cobbled together some experimental results, sent them to Brian Josephson.
Okay, now Brian Josephson is a very, very big guy in science. He is a Nobel laureate, major physicist.
He discovered the Josephson junction and quantum tunneling and so he's not a lightweight, and that's an understatement. So Brian Josephson, let this be a lesson to you folks out there in radio land. The bigger they are, the nicer they are. So Brian Josephson forwards my email to Gerald Pollack, who is the author of a book called The Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life, and who is the sort of the most prominent water researcher who picked up where Gilbert Ling left off. Ling was a Chinese-American physicist who proved that water structure is what gives mitochondria cell energy to the body. In fact, he proved that many Nobel Prizes that were doled out on the basis of the mythology of the so-called the sodium-potassium pump is a pure fiction. There isn't enough energy in the body to do the kind of work that cells do using a pump. So Ling,
the so-called sodium pump.
Correct. Ling was a brilliant physicist who proved beyond any shadow of any doubt that the cells in the body run on structured water, the lack of which leads also to disease. So Pollock picked up from where Ling left off and proved that there's a fourth phase of water that is a kind of a gelatinous phase. It's the phase water goes through between it's a cold state and the beginning of the formation of ice crystals, which is a kind of a gel.
The super cool state?
Yes, and this fourth phase of water has weird behaviors, and one of which is if you put a tube of Nafion, which is a special polymer, in water, it will structure the water, and the water will flow through the tube without any external inputs. It just runs like free energy. Anyone can Google Gerald Pollock. He gives many lectures, and he organized this water conference where I presented last year. So here I am. Here's, you know, Tim, the garage inventor, presenting to, you know, Luc Montagnier, who won the Nobel Prize for his discovery of the AIDS virus, and Voyakov, and all these brilliant people showing these experiments. And, of course, there was quite a bit of consternation because they wanted to know exactly how I did it. I said, I'm sorry, I'd have to kill you if I told you exactly how I did it, because I have proprietary agreements with folks. But the results speak for themselves. And so after my presentation, I was approached by a German-American gentleman who claimed to have had a water that had certain properties that were similar to what I was reporting. The plants grew faster, they rotted more slowly, and the water was more hydrating, and on and on and on. And I began to suspect that there was something similar with this water and what Dr. Flanagan refers to as so-called Hunza water. And lo and behold...
What kind of water does he call it?
Hunza water from Hunza. Pakistan, which was rich in silica deposits.
Ah, okay.
So in the body is made up of silica. You're a collagen and your collagen is silica. So you can't really live without silica because your body runs on semiconduction, and silica is a semiconductor. So I said, well, how? Okay, fair enough. So what's this water? So he showed me the water. I treated it right there on the spot. We drank it, and it was much slicker. And he said, we have to collaborate. Excuse me. So I agreed to do some independent testing on his water. It did behave differently, and here's how it was actually very different. It's very strange. We took curcumin, which is probably the most studied phytocompound, owing to its anti-cancer and anti-inflammation properties.
You probably should define a phytocompound.
Yeah, just a plant extract. So curcumin is what Indian food is spiced with. It's curry. That's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Curcumin is curry. So in concentrated form, curcumin, I think there are 7,000 plus studies on curcumin, just on its anti-cancer properties. But they have a heck of a time getting it into the body and getting it metabolized.
I'll tell you what, hold it there. We're at the top of the hour. We are actually up for a station break, and then we'll come back with my guest this morning, Tim Winey. And we'll be talking more about water and the remarkable properties of water. I mean, they say when you're looking for life in any planet in the universe, follow the water. Well, maybe that's a prescription that we should look into a lot deeper. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. You're on the other side of midnight, and we shall return. Oh, this is one of my favorite songs. Oh, there is such a story attached to this. Supertramp, Take the Long Way Home. Let's listen to this, because this is meaningful, as you're going to hear in a moment.
So you think you're Romeo, playing a part in a picture show, but take
must say, that song brings back so many memories. It's amazing how music, again, frequency, triggers so much, Tim. I mean, it's like frequency surrounds us. We're basically creatures of frequency, and we try to separate the world, and part of what you're trying to do is to restructure and rediscover the interconnections between things that people think are due to one thing, and they turn out to be due, again, to frequency.
Right, and this brings us to, you know, it's the grown-up notion that, you know, we are responsible for our thoughts and how they impact our health. And, of course, Marcel Fogel, who was a famous IBM researcher who actually invented the hard drive, among other things, was famous also for his ability to somehow, with intention, imbue crystals, very specially cut crystals with this intention that could then be used to treat liquids. So he actually had a kind of an analogous process to what I'm doing, albeit driven by his mental power. And in fact, in Sweden last summer, I met Stephen Schwartz, who was one of the original remote viewing people. And he hired Ingo Swann. I said, "Do you know Ingo Swann?" He said, "I hired Ingo Swann." So I reeled off this list of people, and I said, "Let's just cut to the list of people you don't know." So Stephen Schwartz is at the heart of all that. And I said, "Let me ask you something. Did sacred sites, were they selected because they have special energies associated with them, or were they imbued with some kind of intention? Because many of these sites are made up of, you know, silica rock, and there'd be crystals." And, and he said both. He said he thought that early peoples were more tuned into these earth energies, and they built sacred sites and monuments along these ley lines or nodal points. And of course, I live at the end of the St. Michael line here in England that terminates right where I am. And the Azores is, you know, highly paramagnetic. And so this is a sideline, but it's worth mentioning. I've actually taken water and placed it in libation bowls in temples found in the Azores that are thought to be Phoenician. I think they're much older. In fact, they're laid out in the form of the female reproductive system. It's very strange. And I was able to show sped up chemical reactions on water that was placed in these libation bowls, both in the Azores Islands and in Malta at the big megalithic sites.
Tell you what, hold it there. We're at 5 after the hour. When we come back, we're going to pick up on this, and then I'm going to get into the experiments that you might be able to do. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Tim Winey, we're discussing torsion and how you can do it at home and see remarkable results. We shall return.
If there's one thing in my life that's missing, it's the time that I spend alone. Sailing on the cool and bright clear water.
As you may note, we have a theme going tonight. We're doing water music because Tim is talking about water experiments. Okay, let's get into the heart of this. The experiments, how do you do them, and what are the effects, and why should the rest of us care?
Right. So backing up to this German gentleman, well, I will give folks something to play with. And these were the early experiments I did. I took magnetite or paramagnetic sand, black sand, as recommended by John Maluski, and just surrounded water with that. So you take a bottle of water and you put a few inches of the sand around it, and you let it sit for a couple of days, and you will see differences. For example, one of the most straightforward experiments.
So wait a minute. You have water in. Does the container make any difference? Plastic, glass, metal?
No, because torsion fields have the penetrating power of neutrinos.
Well, remember, we're talking about people that don't know this, so we have to, you know, And you obviously don't want plastic that's been sitting in the sun, because that bakes out all kinds of stupid stuff out of the plastic that contaminates your water. So you got to pretend, you got to make sure that the water is being treated with respect, right?
Yeah, yeah. And but you could take a bottle of Coca-Cola, right? Mm-hmm. And bury it in black sand, and then
this is the kind of sand you have on beaches, like in Hawaii.
Correct. And you can take that then pour it out and add a mint candy to it, and it'll give you a more robust nucleation reaction. It'll create smaller bubbles much more energetically. So one will just sort of fizz, and the other will just billow over the rim of the cup. Mm-hmm. They're actually quite dramatic. So even simple things like that, you can show big physiochemical differences.
So wait a minute. Hang on. let's not lose the details. So you take water in, let's say, a plastic bottle, and you or Coke, okay, let's take the Coke, and you add the Mentos, right? And you get an overflow reaction. Now you take the same Coke and you put it in a container with this sand, black sand, and you let it sit there for a couple of days, right? And then you open it and put the Mentos in that, and you'll get a much bigger reaction, you say, because of the interaction of the magnetite in the sand with the Coke in the bottle.
Correct. And we believe it affects the hydrogen bonding within the water molecules. In other words, water clusters differently depending on the hydrogen bond angles, which are flexible. And that's what Stephanie Seneff says. She says if water isn't clustered in tight pentagonal arrays, then you end up with disease. In fact, I can spit in two Petri dishes of water and zap one of them, and nothing will grow in it, whereas the other will just be covered in gunk within a few days. I mean, we've done endless experiments where we've shown that this inhibits microbiology. It's really astonishing. So this German gentleman said, look, we have to collaborate. So I said, fair enough. So we did testing on his water, which has silica in it. And we mixed this curcumin, this Indian spice, with this silica water. And normally when you mix curcumin with water, it oxidizes very rapidly. Anybody out there who's ever juiced a carrot knows that if you leave it out for even a few minutes, it turns brown before your very eyes, right?
Oxygen.
This curcumin just stays yellow. It doesn't
oxidize. Oh, it doesn't oxidize?
It doesn't oxidize. And that's what Flanagan said about these huns of water. He said you could put stuff in it and it wouldn't rot, okay? And guess what else doesn't rot? Stuff in pyramids. Because, once again, magnetite is just a bunch of little pyramids, okay? So it is pyramid power. So we zapped this curcumin. I even microwaved it. So we mixed curcumin with water, microwaved it, after having structured it, and it wouldn't oxidize. So it even survived that. So needless to say, he was very excited about adding this structuring process to a product that had already shown itself to be different from normal water. And so he's now trying to commercialize a face cream with this. So you put this cream on your face made with this water, and with resveratrol, which is another phyto compound which has anti-aging, anti-cancer properties. There's a lot of research on resveratrol also. And he did this facial study recently where it looks like plastic surgery. They look fake. I mean, they look Photoshop, but they're not. They're forensic photographs under the same lighting. Everything's the same. And these are really dramatic improvements in facial complexion and wrinkle.
So wait, you're saying that this guy is mixing this structured water with a face cream or some kind of thing that women apply to their faces, and then he's taken before and after photographs, and the treated materials are showing a demonstrable difference.
It looks fake. It looks like plastic surgery. I mean, people are stopping them and saying, when did you have that done? You know, I mean, it almost looks too good. You know, it's like Japanese in 30 minutes. It's really hard to believe. But
where can you get a tube of this stuff?
Well, that study was done using a formulation that was made just for that. He's now ramping up production and looking to commercialize it. So I'll have to get back to you on that. So he's just in the process of launching this.
Because I know someone who would be really, really, really interested in that.
Okay.
Does a lot of experiments with face creams and non-hyperallergenic stuff and all that. I mean, this sounds incredibly interesting.
You're not talking about Glenn Ryan by any chance?
No.
Okay. So anyway, now that's interesting and of benefit, I guess you could say, but not nearly as exciting as what happened recently with this little dog, which I almost hesitate to tell you because it just sounds like it sounds so crazy.
Hey, come on, we're on the other side of midnight.
So I'm on Skype. How's this for serendipity, Rupert Sheldrick? I'm on Skype with this German-American guy talking strategy.
Who you met at the conference.
Correct. And I get a phone call, so I'm talking to two people at once, from my buddy here in England who helped me with some machine work. He actually helped me design this torpedo putter, which I invented some years ago, and a golf club. And he said, our little dog, our little Shih Tzu, has been diagnosed with terminal lymphoma, covered with tumors.
Aww.
The vet gave it, you know, gave him, I don't know, a few weeks to live, and he doesn't seem to be in much pain, but they want to give him steroids. What do you suggest? I said, well, I'm talking to Rolf here on the phone, who sent me some curcumin, which is a well-known anti-inflammatory. I wasn't even thinking about cancer. I said, you could give this to the dog. They actually have a dog paste they give to dogs made with this structured water. I said, you could give him this paste and see if it helps with inflammation. That's all I can say. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So he gives this dog this paste. It's just fat and protein and a little structured water. It's just like a little nutritional snack, along with this curcumin mixed in also with this specially structured water. And, you know, the vet said, look, he's 12 years old, he has a heart condition, he's deaf, he's had both ear canals removed, he's going blind. We're not going to do chemotherapy on a 10-pound Shih Tzu, 12-year-old Shih Tzu. We're just not going to do it, so fair enough. So they weren't going to treat him anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so he calls me a few weeks later and he says, look, I guess it was like 6 weeks later. So he calls me and he says, look, we went to a follow-up with the vet. And they did an ultrasound, and they can't find any cancer in this dog whatsoever. I mean, not a cell, okay? So
they religiously gave him this paste and water, yeah. What, with his food or before or after or something every day, you know, for like 6 weeks?
Yeah. And I know this little dog. I've known this little dog since it was a puppy. I've known the guy for 12 years. And he brought the dog to my house. I palpated these tumors. They were like tangerine size, so he was covered in tumors. I physically felt these tumors on this dog. Gone.
Wow.
So then it gets weirder. So then he calls, and then my friend calls me. You got to be careful what you wish for. He starts complaining about this little dog, waking him up at 2 a.m. to play fetch.
Oh, my God. The dog was regressing to a younger age.
Now, this dog was, you know, sleeping 9/10 of the day, barely able to eat, just dragging his behind around. So then the little dog, who's neutered, by the way, and 12 years old, hasn't shown interest in sex since he was 2.
Oh, my.
Starts mounting the other little dog. So it gets even wackier. So my friend comes over to the house. I said, you have to bring him over. We have to photograph this dog. I said, what the hell did you do to him? He said, what do you mean? I said, he looks like a chow. The hair was just sticking straight out, and it was orange. So these Shih Tzus, they have different colors. It's a rare color, but there's a kind of a strawberry blonde Shih Tzu where they have like little orangish kind of a tinge to the hair.
Right.
So this dog's hair reverted back to its true color.
Oh, my God.
And it looked
God.
Like he had blow-dried it, just preparing it for a dog show. And he said, no, that's just his normal hair. I said, well, do you remember what it looked like before? It was just matted. You know, it was just flat. So he had this hair that just looked so thick and sticking out like fur.
So it was vibrant, and it was younger, it was fluffy,
yeah.
It was
I mean,
full.
Behaviorally, you wouldn't believe it. So this German guy says, look, people don't believe me, but there are people who've given just a dab of this water to dogs that were just literally laying down dead, and they jumped up and started running around. I mean, instantly. It doesn't work in humans. If a human drank this water, they're not affected the same way. We don't know why. I mean, it still has health benefits, but in animals, in particular dogs, they just immediately respond to it. So, needless to say...
Well, this is a huge area of research, Tim. Come on.
Yeah. And then, so this guy, this buddy of mine, he stupidly, I don't know if he was just ashamed to ask me for more stuff or he lost track. I said, don't go on vacation. Don't run out of this stuff. Don't skip a day. If you get low on this, call me. I have plenty more. So, I don't know. He ran out. He didn't give it to the dog for a few days. The lymph nodes swelled up. And he went back to the vet. And the vet said, oh, he's gonna. It's. These are the last stages. Prepare for the worst. You know.
Right.
So he calls me back and says the tumors are back. I said they're not back. Tumor doesn't grow overnight. He's probably the glands are swelling up. But anyway, so we started giving it to him religiously again. The curcumin goes back again to the vet. Can't find anything. So this dog was diagnosed like three times with imminent death. Right. And of course. He's tumor-free now. He died very recently of congestive heart failure. These little dogs get valve pits. You know, their valves go bad and the blood flows the wrong way. It's a common thing in small dogs. But he lasted 8 months, you know, past what was like a 2-3-4 week, you know, certain death diagnosis. He way outlasted any of the odds on this terminal stage. They call it stage 4/5 lymphoma, which means goodbye, Charlie. In fact, there were two other dogs diagnosed with very similar staging, and you know, one was dead in 2 weeks, and the other, I think, in 4 or 6 weeks. So he did pretty well. He lasted 8 months, and he had other health problems. But I mean, his behavior alone. I mean, you would never in a million years think that was a 12-year-old dog. He was. I have an interview. I interviewed him in my garden, and you show this dog running around. I mean, it's amazing.
So you have this on video?
Yeah, yeah.
Excellent. Oh, do you have any more of the stuff left?
Oh yeah, I'm after this, I'm taking it myself.
Because I would like to do some experiments. I have some ideas, but again, it's what can we measure, Tim? You know, it's one thing to have anecdotal information, but to get it rigorous, to get it whether it's reproducible every single time. So, did you do a back engineering as to what was happening with the dog and the? Whatever
well,
the mixture
was. We have to be logical about things. We have to look to Stephanie Senna for an explanation of how water structure implicates.
Yeah, I need to get her on the show. I definitely
you
need
do.
To talk
I mean,
to her.
She's absolutely brilliant. And by the way, we suspect strongly that whatever inhibits this oxidation it must be a clue to why it seems to be taken up better and better utilized in the body. And trust me, the big pharma, they're quite interested in curcumin. You know, people always say, oh, these home remedies and all these herbs and spices. Come on. If that stuff was really that great, the big boys would be after it. Well, only if it's patentable. And by the way, they tried to patent curcumin, but there's an international agreement, fair use type agreement that is in place whereby countries can challenge this. So I think it was... I don't want to name names, but it was one of the big pharmaceutical companies that tried to patent curcumin. And India said, time out. We've been using this for 5,000 years. So they put an injunction on them, and, of course, it went to court. And they said, are you crazy? Did you think nobody was going to notice that you're trying to patent curcumin? Are you out of your mind? So they threw it out of court. So curcumin is not going to be patented, and therefore – it's not going to be able to recoup a $2 billion investment and be able to ride on a patent, obviously.
Right.
So curcumin is fair use, and it is what it is. It's a time-tested antimicrobial, anti-cancer, anti-inflammatory, anti-everything that's bad for you. It even works. It's even been shown to reverse dementia, all kinds of crazy effects. And again, that goes back to, how could one substance...
So, hang on. If you're mixing curcumin, if it works by itself, but you mix it with structured water, you're basically, like in homeopathy, you're potentiating the combination.
Yeah, puts it in a form that allows a body to take it up and utilize it. Otherwise, it's just, I mean, the simple analogy I can give you is that when folks start drinking structured water, their urination rate goes way up. I mean, they just pee like crazy. Well, what's happening is you're displacing unstructured water with structure. In fact, every now and then you hear about somebody who dies of kidney failure or something because they drink so much water. You
know? Right.
They actually die of water poisoning. I'm not convinced you could drink too much structured water. I wouldn't try it, but it just seems like it just you can just drink it almost. I don't want to be crude, but you could almost stand at the toilet just drink it. You know, just go right through you.
Kind of in come out go. Okay.
Yeah, it's so different.
All right, look. We only have this show is going by too fast. We've got a ton of pictures. I want to get to the pictures. Let's go to theothersideofmidnight.com. Click on Radio with Pictures. That will take you to tonight's guest. Scroll down to Tim's items. And I don't know whether we put these in any particular order, but I wanted to get to the videos because I wanted to show people. I guess we go down to 13, maybe. This was what you presented at the conference.
Yeah, that's
these were side-by-side comparisons. So we've got about 4 minutes to the bottom of the hour. We'll pick this up when we come back. I'll give out phone numbers. I'll tell everybody, you know, go to Facebook again if you want to join the conversation, if you want to talk about what you're going to see, which is kind of amazing, Facebook and Twitter. And again, if you want to go to the archive and save this program and listen to it again and look at the videos, that's how you do it. You interrelate the program with Club 19.5. And that way you have the complete experience, which is to connect all these dots. This program with other programs, programs on water, programs on the physics. We're trying to build a new set of disciplines here. And, you know, that's what Timothy is here for tonight, to talk about his experiments. So let's go to Radio with Pictures. And do we want to go to 13?
Well, I mean, it's a fairly lengthy presentation. I mean, basically, I just show a range of experiments there that highlight, you know, all of the really strange anomalies surrounding these effects. There is a picture above that. Let's see. There's a series of pictures. The last picture shows a high-speed gas chromatograph. I should talk about this. I went to a university in northern England and had...
Yeah, we only got a couple of minutes in this section. So which number should we go to click on?
So it's number 10. It's the bottom of number 10.
Okay.
So if you look in the bottom right-hand corner...
That's the graph. Okay.
Yeah. So I went up to this university, had this chemistry professor run these high-speed gas chromatograph sniff tests. It's literally an electronic nose. And this electronic nose piggybacks on this Luca Turin theory of smell. So basically they bombard a crystal with vaporized whatever, and it gives you a spectra. And this is a device that's approved by both the FDA and the DEA. So it sniffs drugs, it sniffs rotten food. It's actually a very sophisticated unit. It's called the Z-nose. And so what we did was we zapped samples of lemonade sweetened with stevia, which is a natural sweetener, gin, wine, all of which measured very differently. In fact, the wines measured more different than two different varieties of wine, even though it was from the same bottle. I mean, completely different. So one really exciting area of exploration here that actually looks like it's going to be commercialized, stevia is 250 to 300 times sweeter than sugar, but it has a weird aftertaste. People don't like stevia.
No, I don't like stevia.
It's safe and it's healthful, but it tastes funny.
Oh, Robin swears by it.
Yep. Well, we can zap.
I'll tell you what, hold it there. We'll zap after we come back at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. Go to Facebook and Twitter and talk about us because, well, we're talkable this morning. You're on the other side, and we shall return. And we are back with another water song. By the way, today is the 27th. Yes, it's 27th all day, as my mother used to say. And it's Vic Mignogna's birthday. Happy birthday, Vic. You know, he plays Captain Kirk in the Star Trek Continues series. We've had him on as a guest. We're going to have him back. Live long and prosper, Vic. Okay, my guest this morning, Tim Winey. We're talking about water. Let's go to Radio with Pictures. Let's go back to the graph, number 10. So we've got stevia with lemonade. We've got a blue control. We've got red, which is structured. What am I looking at in the graph?
Yeah, so if you sniff the same substance twice, and this machine is calibrated correctly, you will get an absolutely perfect tracing of both colors. And he showed me this. We baselined it and tested it and cleaned the sensor and so on. So it's a very accurate machine. We've got wildly diverging spectra on all things sniffed, including the stevia, which explains why I'm able to drink gallons of sweetened lemonade that would send anyone into a diabetic coma if it were sugar. And I hate the taste of stevia. It revolts me.
Yeah, Robin introduced me to stevia. I found that if you really, really are careful and you get just the right amount, but you got to be so finicky.
Right.
And who's finicky?
And,
you know, you're putting.
Yeah, and here I just dump ungodly amounts in. You can't add too much. It just gets sweeter. There's no upper limit.
Nope.
So there's obviously great interest in that because it has major implications for obesity. I mean, if kids were drinking stevia sweetened sodas, you know, I mean, obesity would be cut in half overnight.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I've used stevia with Robin for years, and we give it to our dog, and, you know, I haven't had a cold in several years. I wonder why.
Well, by the way, stevia is not only not harmful, it's actually been shown to have many health benefits, including some pretty powerful evidence that it even has some anti-cancer properties.
Hmm.
And interestingly, it's coming online. I mean, they're trying to get the stink out of it. Coke just got issued a ridiculous 157-page patent on every possible combination of stevia and every other sweetener on the planet. They're trying to corner the market on this. But again, it's a natural product. It's a plant-derived product. It's safe. And we're able to add it to anything with no seeming upper limit. And so it's very exciting. I mean, that's just very recent, actually.
Okay, let's go to the pictures because I wanted to show people some of these experiments, and time is running out. So where should we dip in?
Well, I think one of the more striking is actually just under these facial pictures, before and after facial pictures. If you look here, you'll see kind of an orange glass.
Number five?
Yeah.
Where it says oil and water.
Yeah, five and six. And actually, the number five is part of a video in my presentation. So it shows me mixing what is a mixture of, I think, peanut oil, water, and a denture cleansing tablet acting as a surfactant to sort of break up the tension.
Right.
And so I mix these two, and then almost immediately you see a rapid separation of these boundary layers. So you see orange and then clear. Well, that's the structured one. So the boundary layer is much more clearly delineated.
That's the glass
bigger
on the left.
Correct. Now, in picture number six, you see an almost perfect orange line. It looks like it was drawn with a laser. That is also a consistent effect. So when we mix disparate liquids like water, and we get these absolutely perfect straight
boundary layers. So wait, the glass on the left is structured water. The
Correct.
Glass on the right is non-structured.
Correct. And you will never, nature never creates a perfectly straight line like that between an oil and water mixture. You know, you don't get those when you add a surfactant. So nobody can explain that. And I showed many examples of that. Another curious one here, I just literally spat into some ethanol. And if you look at number eight there, that's a normal blob of saliva sitting in a solvent, sitting in ethanol.
Right.
And you look on number nine there, and you see this almost galactic kind of a swirl. And so a completely different interaction between this solvent and this hydrocarbon, or this saliva.
In other words, we're comparing number 8 with number 9.
Correct. And so they couldn't be more different. One just looks like a blob that you would expect, and the other is dispersed out in what looks like the beginning of a hurricane forming. So really very different effects, and they're consistently reproducible. I mean, I've repeated these experiments almost exhaustively. It's getting a bit silly.
Well, you used to send me these wonderful videotapes with the lava lamps and some of the beer and the oil and water, and you'd send me unstructured, and then you'd send me structured, and it was night and day. It was obvious.
I mean, the lava lamp thing is so strange.
Tell them about the lava lamp thing.
Yeah, here you have, first of all, lava lamps are hermetically sealed. You know, they have like a
bottle cap. People who weren't born in the 70s, describe what a lava lamp is.
Yeah, it's just a lamp that you heat using like a 40-watt bulb below it, and it's a mixture of wax, basically, a special proprietary mixture of wax and water. And, of course, it starts off a convection, so you get these bubbles that gurgle up and reform and agglomerate and move around. So it's a great example of convection of two different substances with different, specific gravities, and so they separate from each other, but they interact. And when you structure a lava lamp, what you get is a stable hourglass shape that doesn't pinch off. It just swells up and then shrinks and swells and shrinks, and you get a tiny little waist that normally would have long pinched off that swells back up again, which I can only surmise holds its shape because there must be some torsion there. It must be twisting to be able to hold it in this stable configuration. Very strange.
So, again, I was hoping we would have a video to actually demonstrate next
time.
That's in the
Varna video.
These experiments, let me actually just click on this and see what's in this video. Number 13, this is you at the conference.
My name is Timothy Winey. I've been working
Let me turn down the noise. We don't want the noise on this. Okay.
And if you scroll ahead, I do a little brief introduction, and the very first thing I show is the lava lamp.
Okay. And it's let me go back to
lava lamps.
Oh, here we are.
There's two different sets of lamps I show.
Yeah, it's at about...
It's a minute 220-ish.
Okay. So, yeah, if we mine are at 232. Oh, look at that.
Obviously sped up for brevity.
Yeah, no, this is wonderful. These are sped up, yeah. So at 232, just look at the lava lamp. The one on the left is unstructured. The one on the right is structured, right? Tim?
I'm sorry, I had you muted there.
That happens to the best of us. So the left one is unstructured, and the right one in these examples is structured.
Correct.
Wow, look at the difference. And these are, of course, sped up, but still, it's relative time.
Yeah, it's nuts. I mean, there's no reversal of the film. There's no trick photography here.
We keep talking about structure. What are you doing to the water? This is the MacGuffin, and I promised people they'd be able to do some of this stuff at home. How do you structure water to begin to see the difference?
Again, if you put a magnet next to a lava lamp, you wouldn't get this. So these are really robust effects. But you can get effects like the nucleation differences using just black sand. So if you get your hands on some paramagnetic sand, which most people can get, even a thin layer, you don't need, inches of the stuff. I even took magnetite, paramagnetic sand, and literally sprinkled it onto containers with some adhesive spray paint, and it was enough to create an effect. So you don't need much, because remember, these are thousands and thousands of little pyramids. So they're quite powerful. A bunch of little pyramids is equal to one big one, as they'll say.
Okay. So people could find black volcanic sand, surround water containers, you do a control, water mixed with other things like beer or, other things you dump in, and you'll see differences between the water that you packed around with the sand around it and then the water that you just got from the tap, right?
You bet. In fact, fruits that are structured in these environments are sweeter and I mean, Flanagan talks about this in his book. Even tobacco, which I don't recommend smoking, but even it'll even change the taste of tobacco. So anything that affects taste and sense can be affected by torsion fields, which again goes to vibration, back to Luca Turin, quantum theory of smell. All is quantum, all is vibration.
So what are some of the things that you're thinking that you might want to market out of this research? Because it seems to me, you know, if we go back to radio with pictures, the idea of women who can look at their you know, comparison photographs and see if they use this cream, you know, let's say number one, if they use this cream, it gives them this result. That's an astonishing picture.
Well, look, I mean, structured water, putting aside creams and phytocompounds and other things, just structured water alone is more hydrating. We can show that using polymer beads. We can show that they literally take on more water. So just on that alone, look at older people that are chronically dehydrated because they don't like to drink water, they forget. They can drink this water more easily. It doesn't land heavy on the stomach. It's more hydrating. You know, I tried to convince race horse people to give it to their horses because obviously, you know, they could drink less water before the race and still be hydrated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, athletes, you name it. I mean, everyone can benefit from structured water. I personally am now convinced after my most recent experiments with hydrogels showing very different cross-linking behaviors that this water has a higher zeta potential. That is to say, it can hold more material. So what does that mean? Well, that means it can carry more nutrients to your cells and more waste away more efficiently. So the whole system runs more efficiently. So I think there's got to be room out there for just a purely structured water product, as well as in combination with these creams and phytocompounds, which, of course, are being commercialized through the Swiss company. I'm also pursuing the stevia for obvious reasons, and we are in discussions with some folks on the fuel for some fairly limited but still very important environmental applications.
Okay, the ancients built thousand-ton pyramids to concentrate, to amplify the torsion field. And they did it because it gave them health benefits and it gave them cultural benefits. And the reason I know that is when Robin and I went to Chichen Itza, I've told the story a couple of times, I guess, we had a Mayan guide at Chichen Itza. We had a Mayan guide at Tikal. And I'm measuring the pyramids with the Accutron. And he's looking at the screen and he says, "Oh my God, my grandmother used to tell me that these things did this stuff, but we were never able to see it. You're showing me what they're doing," because we were showing the changes in the frequency of the Accutron sitting literally with our legs dangling over the top of this pyramid in the complex. So what he told me was that during the certain festivals in the spring, the farmers, the peasants, you know, would bring their crops in for this festival, and they'd put them at Tikal in the city square between these two huge pyramids. And they'd leave them there for 2 weeks while they went through, you know, what festivals are all about. At the end of the 2 weeks, they would take those seeds back to him. They would take them back and they would plant them, and they would get enormous yields from just having left these bags of seeds in the vicinity of these pyramids for a couple of weeks.
Now, Krasnohalovitz did that in Russia and the Ukraine.
Yes. Now, you've been able to somehow collapse this process with some kind of machine technology where you're able to charge or create a torsion field that is so much bigger than these pyramid fields, but you don't want to tell people tonight how you do that.
Well, here's the bad news. The bad news is the equipment used to charge these intermediate substances is obviously proprietary, and I'm sworn to secrecy on that. The chargers themselves have a limited lifespan. They do kind of decohere. So,
no, wait, when you say the chargers, it means you have a machine and it charges something, kind of like a charge carrier. That thing is used then to expose water, gasoline, diesel fuel, whatever, and that eventually runs down and you have to go and recharge it back at the machine?
Correct. You can recharge it in an indefinite number of times, but it doesn't last in and of itself forever.
How long does it last?
About a month. So we can't sell them, as it were, because they'd be like disposable, it'd be wasteful. So we're only doing projects where we can be assured that there'll be an exchange process built into it. So they give us the old ones, we charge them up, send them a new one, that sort of thing. So it's not economical to sell these to people. It just doesn't work out that way. So we're just working directly with folks who need to structure water, need to structure wine, need to structure fuel, what have you.
But if you can't do it, if you can't commercialize it, and like Henry Ford, do it on an assembly line, how can you reach civilization? How can you reach enough people to make a difference?
Well, because you can charge plenty of water. I can charge 1,000 liters of water in 5 seconds.
Okay. And you say it holds its charge. We're using charge
forever,
as
So the target substance, the water, the fuel, the wine, that's irreversible. Not even microwaving will undo that.
But the intermediary, what you call the charge carrier, that only has like a month's lifetime, and then you have
to go. Correct, which is very strange. How is it possible that the target, which is a liquid, which is normally very fragile, could hold this effect indefinitely? I mean, we had this chemist sniff this gin samples using this chromatograph, and those were a year old, and they measured completely different.
So you can actually now measure with the gas spectrometer, gas chromatograph or spectrometer, you can actually measure the difference between the structured material and how it smells and the unstructured material and how it smells. And you say that effect is permanent.
Permanent. In fact, as is the fuel effects, water effects, all these effects are, for all intents and purposes, permanent. Now, I don't have 10-year-old samples of water because I haven't been doing this for 10 years. But in practical terms, nobody sits on water for 10 years anyway. There'd be no need to do that.
No. So this is the proprietary part. You've got a technology that you can use to charge an intermediate substance, a material. You take that material, you bring it near water or wine or anything else you want to structure, fuel, you know, in your car, in your lawnmower, whatever. And that effect is transferable. You can transfer the torsion from the carrier to the experimental sample.
In fact, you can even do doping with certain substances. For example, if I charge a gallon of gasoline and I add that to a nearly full tank of fuel in my vehicle, it will be as if I structured every drop of
this. Oh, my God, it spreads through the rest of the material.
Instantly.
So it must be doing something with the spin. It's got to be rearranging the spins.
Yes, it must be a quantum spin effect, to use a classical description.
Yeah. Mixing our physics metaphors, Natalie. I mean, this is really cutting-edge tabletop science. I mean, this is so exciting because, look, I want to leave people tonight in the show with things that they can do. So let's limb out what they can do to demonstrate for themselves in their own kitchen, in their garage. This is real. This is real science. This is really reproducible. And the implications are staggering if we could democratize this to the entire planet.
Right. I mean, I would suggest on a limited scale to play around with either paramagnetic sand or alternatively...
I know what you have to define. Paramagnetic sand is like this black sand.
Black sand, just like Hawaii sand, that sticks to a magnet. If it sticks to a magnet, it's paramagnetic.
Excellent. Now, where can you find... If I'm in Kansas, Dorothy, right, where do I go to find paramagnetic sand?
I mean, most soil has some in it. I mean, you could literally go outside with a permanent magnet and probably collect enough in the dirt, you know, to start playing around with it. But the stronger sand seems to be...
Now, can you buy this like it was some... It must be really cheap from Edmund Scientific or something?
You could. It's heavy. I mean, but you could, yeah. I mean,
but you don't need much.
No, you don't need a lot. You don't need a lot.
And it doesn't wear out. It's permanent.
Correct. It never wears out because little pyramids, as long as they don't change shape, I mean, you can't even melt it. You know, magnetite, you can't even melt it. So
wait a minute. You're saying it's not the field, the concentrated magnetic field of the magnetite. It's the actual geometry of the crystals that's doing the things with torsion that's kind of alongside what we think of as the magnetic field.
I believe it's the geometry that sets up the magnetic field.
In other words, if they weren't shaped like that, they wouldn't attract to a magnet. I think you're right. Okay, so.
Which means there's no such thing as magnetism. Magnetism is a side effect of torsion.
Well, wait a minute. Faraday proved that. The homopolar generator shows us that magnets don't generate a field. They merely kind of constrain it. They kind of guide it.
Correct.
Okay, so back to the tabletop experiment, because I'm going to leave people with something they can do that's going to blow their minds.
So they can surround target liquids with this black sand, either in thin layers or even like in a bucket.
And you can Google where you are, where you find this kind of sand. I mean, there's tons of help now. Get as much as you can, as pure as you can. You may have to have a chip from a friend that lives in Hawaii. Just have him go and dig up some sand.
Look up John Maluski.
Spell Maluski.
M-I-L-E-W-S-K-I, just like it sounds, Maluski, John.
Okay.
And he has this theory of superlight I talked about earlier, and he has fascinating pictures showing these giant plants in his garden. He sprinkles the stuff on his garden, actually. And then you can make little paper pyramids. I mean, Pat Flanagan talks about that in Pyramid Power. You can just make a little paper pyramid just the size of a hat. And get changes in sweetness and texture in fruits. And I mean, look, the Czechs, way back in the 50s, I think, they had little cartons of milk for school kids that were shaped like pyramids, and the milk kept really much longer.
Well, who was the guy? He was a Hungarian who came up with the concept in the 70s of pyramid power.
Well, that's Flanagan. That's Pat Flanagan.
No, but there was a Hungarian company that actually made little trays of multiple little pyramids.
Yes. Well, and I think he licensed that, actually. I think he's the one that came up with that.
Flanagan licensed that to them, okay.
Yeah, I think so. So, yeah. In fact, it's funny you mentioned him in that context, because he said, the best thing I ever did was write that book, because, you know, he worked in some pretty top secret programs. And he said, ever since then, they left me alone, because they just thought I'd gone off the deep end.
Okay, so if you get sand and you put it around these fuels or liquids, what will people see?
It'll be slicker. The texture of the water will be slicker on the palate. I mean, it'll just fly down your throat. Plants will grow faster to it. Your hair, if you have gray hair, some of it will revert back to its natural color. That's been a general effect of that. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I know it's after midnight, but even after midnight, it just sounds like nuts. How could you reverse gray hair? Well, and we know that gray hair is associated with aging and disease. In fact, what's this rare condition that, you know, only a few people get where they age super rapidly?
Progeria.
Yeah. So, you know, I even wrote the progeria people, and I said, hey, we're getting these hair color changes. Why don't you try giving structured water to these poor kids with this genetic disorder? So, you know, if you think about it, and by the way, your hair can go gray nearly overnight after a big shock like chemotherapy or certain.
Yeah, we should obviously tell the president this, because he's gone very gray in 8 years.
I think he puts flour in his hair when he wants to look cool. On some days it's as black as jet black, and other days he looks like he's been baking, you know.
Interesting. Okay, we have a call here. Let's try to take one call just to keep our chop up. Good morning, 724. Who are you and where are you calling from?
Good morning, Richard. This is Bill from the Dark Woods of Pennsylvania.
Oh, Bill, good morning.
Had a wild thought about this water you were talking about. Does it work in salt water?
That's a good question. I've structured salt water and was able to measure similar differences, chemical reaction rates, iodine starch reaction rates. So, yes, it does work on salt water. In fact, I've tested on seawater.
Well, my theory was, what would happen if you did a gallon of that and then dumped it in the ocean?
You know, the late, great Mei Wan Ho, who needs no introduction, she wrote The Rainbow and the Worm, a real hero of mine. She actually asked that same question. She said, well, if this is an unending hydrogen bonding network, and if you change, you know, a teaspoon of this stuff and you put it in the ocean, where does it end? Because there doesn't seem to be any loss. There seems to be no energetic lost, but I think there are. I think there are practical limits to how much you can infect or dope.
Right.
Well, it would only have to be like 0.00001%, and you'd eventually lose it because the inefficiencies compared to the mass of the ocean would just gobble you up.
Right. But again, I'm able to dope large volumes of fuel with very small amounts. In fact, I only need about a teaspoon of acetone to structure my whole car.
All right. Now, you get that sand from Hawaii. The ocean water touches Hawaii sand in Hawaii.
Right.
Wouldn't that be structuring all the seawater also?
You know, again, you're making Richard's argument for him. Because of the inefficiencies and because of the differences, everything kind of cancels itself out. So you end up with this kind of isotropic universe where two elephants are pushing at each other, but you don't notice it because everything sort of averages out, right?
I'd be curious to see how far out from Hawaii that structured water actually goes.
Hey, guys, I'm curious to see what we're going to do at the end of the program because the music started. Hey, thanks so much, Bill. And, Tim, we got to have you back because I need to discuss more of how we do this on a tabletop. So that's been our Week in Physics, The Other Side of Midnight. Remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.